Hello and welcome to Fresh Out Tokens Podcast. This is Tanya, also known as Cypher Tier, everywhere on the internet. And to my virtual right is David, if you'd like to say good morning.
Hello. How is everyone?
Broken tooth, not a lot of sleep, but hey, it's a great day, and we are very lucky to have Jim Sterling with us, if you'd like to say hello, Jim.
Well, you say very lucky. I haven't spoken yet. I might regret those words, but... Yeah, I'm good. Like as I was telling you before we recorded, I managed to turn my own eyelid in on itself so that it stabbed me in my own eye. I don't know how that works physically or biologically, but I did it. So that there's a little medical marvel for the morning. My eye is still sore, but otherwise, it's been a rip-roaring morning. Other than that, I can't complain too much.
Well, I think we're lucky to have you. And we'll get into some questions and have a chance to chat more after I get through our usual intro spiel, which is we are part of the Geek.fm network, along with Geeks and Sneaks, Chromatic Life, and More Than Bits. We have teas and other items in the I Need Diverse Games Spreadshirt shop, and we split the profits 50-50 with our friend Chachi Bobinks. There's also a blog to compliment the show. Follow us at outoftokenscast.com, and if you have questions, compliments, or hate mail, feel free to drop us a note there as well. You can also follow us on Twitter at outoftokenscast. So now that that's out of the way, for those people listening, Jim, tell us a bit about who you are and what you do.
Right. I suddenly forgot everything about who I am and what my mind was suddenly like, look up your Wikipedia. I guess you could say a critic, pundit, something. I never kind of... have a niche that I feel comfortable saying what it is. I normally just say, like, fat idiot on the internet who just yells really loud. Which kind of covers a lot of the bases. But I guess that the most predominant thing I consider myself would be, I guess, a game reviewer, I suppose. I like to do written reviews, and then my most famous thing is the Jimquisition, which is a weekly... current affairs show about video games, of course, where I... basically just pick on a topic of interest, normally a reaction to some news, normally very anti-corporate in nature, as is my wont, having a go at big publishers, but there's some game design stuff in there as well. Generally just one of those talking heads kind of people, I suppose.
Fair enough. I mean...
I didn't sell myself very well there. that was a very, very muted... I mean, if anyone was interested in my work before they listened to it, they certainly won't be now. But I deserve that because I did not sell myself very well. I'm not a good marketer. That's one of the issues I have. And I rant about marketing and bad marketing a lot in the work I do, but I don't adhere to my own rules. Which is why I go on podcasts and then kind of mutter about what I am in this clueless, unsure way, which just does not make people excited.
Oh, I'm sure that's not true. People were very excited. One of our usual submitter of questions, like, started to send questions, like, the second I tweeted we had booked you for the show, like, a week in advance. You have a lot of fans.
Fortunately, you're at the point where a significant portion of the new people who come to you have already had you described to them.
I think that helps. Yeah, having a reputation that precedes you it takes a lot of the pressure off me. For good or ill, I mean, you know, depending on which corner of the internet you ask, I'm either God's gift or Lex Luthor reincarnated. So, you know, either way it works. Either way, it's a disappointment when they finally get to me. But it's all about the bums in the seats. So once they're sat down, they can't get away. And they've just got to watch the whole show. Which you think wouldn't be possible on the internet. They could just choose to watch something else. But no. They tune in every week and tell me I'm the worst.
I think hate following is its own special brand of dedication.
I feel like it's something I may have leaned into a bit too much over the years. But what you gonna do? It's certainly eased up over the past few years. I mean, even Reddit's 50%. All right about me now, which I think is a real achievement. It's a professional accomplishment that I'm very proud of. 50% of Reddit does not hate me, which, I mean, compared to most people, that's phenomenal. That's statistically impossible.
That's impressive, considering Reddit literally is just like, nope, nope, not going, mm-mm, nope.
Exactly, yeah. Like then I've got like maybe 5 or 6 people who are like, hold on, let's hear him out. That's something I remain incredibly proud of, and I will do to my dying day.
Awesome.
You sort of have to wonder at which point hate following people cuts into your other hobbies, like gaming, for these people.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, I'd say every few months I do like an episode of the Jimquisition that really sets off you know, a particular group of my audience, or at least a group of people who have decided to be my audience for that week. And it is often surprising, like I'll come back and find, you know, I've got the usual ream of death threats and then attacks against the family and all that. So, you know, all the good stuff that we're all so used to and so fond of. And I'll come back after, like, I've spent, like, the past... I'll put up a video, then I'll go and play something either to review it or just for, you know, I'll spend a few hours playing The Binding of Isaac or Star Wars or whatever. And then I'll come back and I'm like, all of this stuff happened, like these essays written about me while I was off actually playing video games, and I'm like, when have they found the time to do it? Like, I'm amazed I find time to do it, let alone if I was spending a lot of that time just talking about people I don't like. Like, I feel there's better things to do.
Spoiler, I'm guessing a lot of people that hate you or what you do actually don't play a lot of games, and they just yell to be yelling.
It's quite, I mean, it's fun to do. I mean, I'm self-employed, so I walk around the house in my underwear just screaming and shouting at random things. So I guess some people prefer to find an outlet for that rather than just screeching into the ether like I do. But I would recommend the ether. It's a lot more... It's a lot more healthy than trying to direct it at someone and then just getting very frustrated and upset when they laugh at you. The ether doesn't laugh at me when I'm yelling in my underpants. I will laugh at you if you yell at me in your underpants. So, you know, I stick with the ether. That's my particular philosophy.
So, what got you into gaming?
What got me into gaming? I mean, video games. That would be my first answer. I liked them. And so I played them. It's always a very blunt question that's hard to kind of have an interesting answer for. I always just really go back to my earliest gaming memory, which is in being in W.H. Smith's, which is just a general all-purpose literature, nominally a bookstore in Britain, but they do a lot of other stuff too. And this was back when they still... It's just the very few last few years where they were still selling cassettes, cassette-based games in stores. And my earliest memory was being in a W.H. Smith's with my grandmother, getting Dizzy Prince of the Yolk Folk for the Commodore 64, I think that was what we played on, Commodore 64. And my brother was always bigger into games, so I was kind of on his shoulder yelling advice, and that's how we played Dizzy. Was he'd do the controls and I'd actually solve all of the puzzles for him. So that's really my earliest thing, and then from there it just sort of transitioned into me playing more and more of them alongside my brother after I got bored of just watching him do it.
Cool. Well, you know, playing games isn't the same as reviewing and critiquing, so what made you decide to start doing that?
It was basically just putting two great flavors that taste great together. One of those situations. Like, I really liked writing and I really liked video games. And I used to write just for my own personal edification about all sorts of topics. And a friend of mine basically just said, like, you really like the video games. Why don't you just try and put these two things together and write about video games? And he actually he worked on a rather famous bit of, I guess, abandonware would be the term. It was an arcade game that never released, but people have been able to play it on MAME and things like that and emulate it. It was Tattoo Assassins, which is the old the fighting game that had followed in Mortal Kombat's footsteps and had a whole bunch of fatalities in it. And it was about people with tattoos on their bodies that they used as weapons. Quite famously terrible game. And he was actually a designer for that game. And was able to tell me a really great story about the game's creation. and just the problems Data East had and the desperation they had in trying to force this game out. So I talked to him about that and worked on this article about the making of Tattoo Assassins, which I pitched eventually to IGN, and they took it up, and it was published on IGN Insider, which was their subscription thing at the time, which I don't think they have anymore, but I could be wrong. It's actually been a long time since I've seen what IGN itself is doing as a site, but yeah, that was kind of my first thing, and then from there stumbled onto Destructoid and all that kind of business. So that was more or less it. It was just me having a go at it and just deciding that two hobbies could be combined and turned into possibly a career.
Awesome. It's certainly been interesting to kind of watch the evolution of just how games critique works in general. But I think you were one of the first people that I knew of to start doing that, like, kind of full time.
I don't know about that. I mean, I guess I came up during what you could call the golden age of games blogs, if games blogs deserve such a grand term. So if your 2006 era, Destructoid itself was starting to legitimize, you had Joystick going, Kotaku, of course, was pretty big at the time. What else was there? There was a whole bunch. Shaq News was pretty prominent at the time. Blues News, Evil Avatar, a whole bunch of these things came up. So I wouldn't say I was the first. I was definitely, I was there at the best time to do it. I was in one of the best positions. And it actually, I mean, it took me a long time, even after I became sort of well-known, to be able to do it as a full-time job. It was a good few years at Destructoid before I was able to do it as work. I was working nights at a cab firm in southeast London, dispatching cars to people who needed them, to the worst people on earth. Because the kind of people who want a cab at 2 a.m. in southeast London, and they're not polite. I'll put it that way, especially because our cars were always late. And that was more or less how I worked for a good long time. And it was a weird duality of my life to spend days having free wine and chat with CEOs of companies, and then turning up to this really awful cabbie's office on Eltham High Street to be screamed at by people outside nightclubs who were drunk and calling me pretty much every name under the sun. And it was a confusing time to be in those two states, to simultaneously feel quite important. However untrue that may have been, but to at least felt important and going around London and doing all sorts of cool things. And then by night, I'm in this, you know, shitty little office being screamed at by people who are just some of the most unpleasant people I've ever had phone conversations with.
Ooh, that has... Well, my former day job was in higher ed, so I, while not as bad as a cabbie thing, having to talk to entitled parents probably ranks up there with things that I don't ever want to do again.
I wouldn't envy that. I know a good few parents, perfectly pleasant people, but some some individuals who, when they have kids, believe it entitles them to be the very worst humans imaginable. I don't get what it is, but you know, again, it's not universal, but some people, they become a parent and then just their switch goes in their brain where that's then their reason and their excuse to just be terrible. So I don't envy that at all. I think I'd actually rather speak to the people who are outside the Venue nightclub at 2 a.m. wondering where their cab was than actually deal with an angry parent.
Yeah.
So you have you've changed a lot over the years. I used to watch your show on The Escapist, by the way. Way back.
Poor you.
In the day.
Oh, way back. I was saying poor you. Some of those early ones were rough.
You basically got up to The Escapist and weaving your story so far.
So between, you know, your work with The Escapist and Destructoid, you've shifted a lot, because I remember reading the interview that's linked in 2013 from Gaming as Women, and you talked about a lot of the changes you've gone through, but that was in 2013. So I was curious as to how you further shifted in terms of your work and the ways that you review content since that interview came out 3 years ago.
It's hard for me to gauge because I think personal changes like that can be very incremental. Mm-hmm. And so it's like a change in your appearance where others may be better at spotting it than you because to you it's a very small thing that changes each and every day. So it's difficult for me to really put a finger on what might have gotten better, what might have gotten worse in the work that I do in the past. I mean, blimey, it was about over 2 years now, almost 3 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a long time, and I like to think that I've gotten better. I mean, obviously, I've since that time gone independent and tried to maintain the same amount of work I do, being completely disconnected from an actual outlet, from any corporate-owned place, from any having any bosses or any of that red tape, which I feel has helped. It's got me more excited about the work I do, and I feel like there's a lot more energy in what I do, and I feel like there's a lot more fearlessness in what I do. I mean, in terms of the stuff specifically covered in that article with regards to, you know, social issues and that kind of stuff, these days I try more to listen than talk, which I feel is just wise, because 50% of the time I don't know what the hell I'm talking about, so it helps to listen. You know, there's that term social justice warrior that gets thrown around, and I prefer to think of myself as more a social justice bard and try and provide party support rather than frontline, which is where I don't really belong. So these days I try and do more signal boosting. I try and get other people some elevation, some recognition and that kind of thing, rather than spend my time talking about things that there are people better qualified to talk about. At least that's what I try and do. Obviously, I'm in that position where I've got a kind of prominent enough following and a varied enough following to where it's like you got a 50-50 shot of the person you're signal boosting benefiting from you doing it or getting kind of unwarranted abuse. And I like to think that the core of my audience isn't abusive and doesn't do the whole harassment thing, but that is always something you've got to be very cogent of. So, yeah, I try and signal boost with permission rather than just sort of, like, idly retweet someone and then run the risk of them getting dogpiled or whatever. So I guess that's kind of the biggest change I've been trying to make, is just be a bit more thoughtful and a little less impulsive.
Oh, that's really awesome, because, I mean... You followed me back after we met at GX3, and, you know, I've talked about this a bit as well, because, I mean, no one knows who I am on the scale. They know who you are. But I still try to be very aware of what I say and how I say it, because it's a little freaky to me to have this many followers on Twitter compared to where I was just a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Even wondering if I signal boost someone, are they going to get harassed, or will this help, or is it bringing unwanted attention? Because, you know, like, you may assume you're doing the right thing or helping someone out, but, like, when someone with 4,000, 50,000, 100,000 Twitter followers retweets you, it opens a door which could be, you know, could lead to great things or to the pits of hell. You never know.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I've been learning more and more as my YouTube channel grows, is, you know, I cover a lot of bad games on Steam. It's part of, you know, I've got a whole whole series called The Best of Steam Greenlight Trailers, where I look at various games that want to be published on Steam, and the idea of it is to be somewhat lighthearted, but also kind of comically despairing as I look at just some of the stuff that people try and pass off. I mean, you look at a game like recently, a game called The Extra Large Testicle, which is exactly what it sounds like. And you just kind of look at these things and laugh. But in some situations, people take what you do and say as tacit permission to then go and be terrible to the developer of said game, which is something I've been trying to kind of deal with and try and, you know, I had to do a video not too long ago that was just, can you just stop doing this? Please don't send death threats to developers. I I shouldn't have to say things like that, but unfortunately you do, because some people just get carried away. And they might not even think what they're doing is that serious. You know, they think they're in on the joke. You know, could they see me tear a game apart and think, that looks like fun, I will go and tell the developer to go die in a house fire and stuff like that. Trying to balance one's own caustic presentation of games and making sure that that caustic presentation doesn't translate into a toxic reaction from the audiences. It's something I am still trying to find the right balance with and trying to maintain. And yeah, that's just something I'm feeling out. It's there. I don't think there's any scientific rule for it. It's one of those things where it's like, how responsible are you? How much can you realistically do without just stopping what you do? You know, I know one channel in particular, Retsoprey, used to do basically Mystery Science Theater riffing on Let's Plays, like other people's Let's Plays, which, again, they'd always tried to do in jest. You know, Slow Beef and Diabetes, I know the pair of them, and I don't think there's a malicious bone in either of them. But their fan base would go onto the channels of said Let's Players and tear them apart in ways that were just, like, really crossing the line. So they kind of stopped doing the entire series, or at least that particular part of what they do. And they had a policy which was very much if the LP'er in question wants the video taken down, they'll comply. And that's a policy I've had to institute with the Best of Steam Greenlight trailers, where it's like, if I get a reasonable request from a developer, the chances are very good I will take it down. I had to do that recently where someone was still just getting continued harassment and threats, to the point where their family contacted me and said, look, can you just take the video down? And I'm like, I can't really argue with it, you know? Like, if something I'm doing is leading to stuff like that happening, then you just gotta put a cap on it.
Yeah, that's really fucking terrible that we're at a point where, you know, this is who you are, this is the way that you talk about things, and people just kind of go way below the line and think this is acceptable and go, well, Jim did it. And it's like, no, that's not actually what Jim said or did. You just went buck wild.
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult, you know. People, I get the sense that there's a group of people on the internet who are always looking for some sort of permission to be terrible, and then they will extrapolate that permission any which way they can. And I've had, you know, my own words, I've seen my own words online twisted to permit that kind of behavior. So yeah, you know, I think that that's always telling when you tell off someone who's been harassing, or tell off a group of people who've been harassing individuals, and they react almost hurt and feel betrayed because they thought you were acknowledging and permitting this. And it's like, no, that's like, you've completely misunderstood. You just wanted an excuse to be an asshole and kind of took whatever permission you read into something. And it's like, no, it's, you don't really have my permission or my endorsement to cross that line into personal stuff. Like go after the product, go after companies. Once you start singling out individuals, getting that personal with them, you know, it's not like I haven't criticized individuals in the past. You know, I'm very famous for criticizing the words of Randy Pitchford, for criticizing the behavior of Peter Molyneux. But you can do that. Like, it may blow some minds, but you can do that without threatening their family or their homes or their livelihoods or their lives.
Amazing that. I wish people would learn.
Yeah, I know. I don't know what kind of weird science it is, but some of us have stumbled on the secret.
If I remember correctly, both of your lengthy criticisms of those two people were purely about what they do for a living.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, one thing I always try and maintain, especially when it comes to Randy Pitchford, who I, you know, quite legendary for getting into spats with. I mean, he's got me blocked on Twitter and everything. And, He's insulted me in public without ever using my name. Like, there's times where he's done interviews or given talks, and it's clear I'm the one he's talking about, because the criticisms he's using are the things he's told me in the past, and I'm like I know exactly who he means. So he and I, like, the enmity between us is well known, but one thing I always try and communicate is it's part of the reason that I might be so harsh with the criticism is because, as a person, I still think he's all right. I just think he tells lots and lots of lies and should maybe not. And you know, focus on being sort of a more honest, more upfront, less misleading, just less shady overall individual in the games industry. And it's his behaviour that rubs me the wrong way. And part of the reason why it rubs me the wrong way is because I always liked the guy. I always liked the guy. I think that's one thing that people misunderstand is when they think there's, you know, a personal grudge that I have against someone is that, you know, I despise everything about them. I mean, even David Cage, who I make fun of, I take the opportunity to make fun of his work and his some of his bizarre statements at any given day of the week. And yet I'm still thrilled he's in the game industry. You know, I may disagree with most of what he says, and I may find his games to be unbelievably vapid, but that he's in the game industry and finding success doing his own weird thing is something I find wonderful, and I don't want it gone. And I think that's a big, big misunderstanding people have about my own work, is that I want to see things destroyed. You know, I might like to see them evolve, I might like to see them change, but I wouldn't like to see them destroyed. I only want to see things get better. Part of the job of a critic is to help shape a medium. I mean, that's part of what criticism is. It's pointing out things that you feel should be improved, could be improved, things that you feel are brilliant and you'd like to see more of. You know, there's a lot of people confusing and conflating criticism with censorship these days. I've been accused of it several times. I've been accused of being pro-censorship because I might point something out in a game that I feel is, you know, untoward, unsavory, that I don't like. And it always confuses me because it's like no one will ever accuse you of censorship if you look at a game mechanic and say you hate that and you don't want to see much more of it in the game industry. You know, if I hate, say, fetch quests, no one ever accuses me of trying to censor a fetch quest. But as soon as it becomes, you know, social issue leaning content, then it's censorship. And I always feel that that's a lot more telling about the people crying censorship than the people actually critiquing the work. So, yeah, it is a weird thing, and I still believe, you know, even with the whole Dead or Alive thing that went on, where people said that I lied to them when I said no one was going to take their anime tits away. You know, no one really took it away. Tecmokoi just decided it wasn't worth their time and effort and money to localize it. It's still available. And, I mean, come on, we're all arguing on the internet. If you want tits, they're everywhere. I'll pull my shirt up on the next Jimquisition if it'll make you feel better. Like, you can get them wherever you want. You know, I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of human bodies and genitalia in all shapes and sizes. And I can get them whenever I want. Like that's the beauty of you know, the market, is when people want something, they can get it. And, you know, they might be not harder to find, but say harder to pick out in an environment where there's a lot more variety. So there's a lot more to choose from. So it might dilute somewhat, but you can always find the kind of entertainment you want. And I don't think critics are a real threat to that. The only thing the only thing a corporation ultimately is going to respond to in a big way is the market itself for a product disappearing. I mean, that's capitalism in a nutshell. And whether you like capitalism or not, I mean, I wouldn't say I'm the hugest fan of it. That's how it works. So I think a lot of people are scared of, and it is fear, but a lot of people are scared of just something they don't need to be scared of. Like, I mean, I look at the games coming out now and I see no shortage of the kind of traditional video games that people are trying to defend from unseen attackers right now. Your Guts and Glory, your TNA, your Violence, and all of the tacky stuff, which I'm a fan of. I mean, I can't stress that enough. I love gauche entertainment. I mean, hell, my one of my favorite horror movie series is Saw, for God's sake. Like as far as gauche nonsense goes, like, that's up there. But there's nothing wrong with sort of the new stuff coming in as well. Like, the existence of your Gone Homes and your Stanley Parables and your Life is Strangers isn't a threat to Doom, to Call of Duty, to Halo, to all of that stuff. It's, you know, it goes back to that zero-sum argument where people think that the existence of one thing takes away from their thing when it's really, it's just more things. And I feel that's ultimately good. You know, it's, everyone can get something they want, which is better than only a few people getting something they want.
I agree entirely. Anyway, do you have any other thoughts about the current state of games journalism and reviewing? You've already sort of touched on it, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting week to ask this question, actually, since Game Trailers shuttered its doors this week, which is a sad thing. I mean, it was one of the institutions way back. I mean, it was YouTube gaming before YouTube gaming was a thing. These were a group of people who saw that wave coming. And I mean, it just goes to show, and it's a scary fact that you can see something coming a mile away, but you're not. That doesn't guarantee that you're going to be prepared to deal with it when it gets here. You know, I've worked for a company before where their favorite phrase was "video is the future." That was their phrase: "video is the future." At the time, I was very obstinate about it. I was, I'm a writer, damn it. I won't be doing any of this video stuff. And so I steadfastly refused to play that ball game. And the ironic thing is here we are in 2016, and, you know, the most famous thing I do is a video series. And, you know, it's pretty damn successful. And the company that said video is the future, they have no video output. They were unable to find a way to present video to be part of that future, and I feel that's kind of what we're seeing here. Is a lot of outlets may have seen what was coming, but just did not know how to deal with it. A lot of them are stuck in their own ways. I wrote an article the day after the Game Trailers shuttering news, where I said that Game Trailers was a victim of itself. And when I say that, I don't mean to be insulting to Game Trailers, which I have a lot of love and respect for, and a lot of love and respect for the people who worked there. But the nature of the beast was what killed Game Trailers. There's a contradictory element to current traditional games media, where you need ad support to make money, but loads of people are using ad blockers, and a single view is worth less than a percentage of a cent in terms of the money they generate from clicking on your article and being exposed to the ads. So at the same time, the audience is all you have, and the audience has no value. And that's not a position to be in. The ads themselves is an issue. You know, ad block made ads harder to serve, so in response, advertising companies made their ads more prominent and obnoxious, leading to those who weren't already using Adblock to want to use Adblock. So that just became a self-destructive problem. And in terms of what we've seen with Game Trailers, and we see it on other sites too, they know YouTube is successful, but they don't make any money on YouTube. I mean, if you look at the YouTube channels of some major game blogs out there, you'd be surprised at how little traffic they actually draw on YouTube. So they make no money from YouTube, and they stick to their own channels. They don't join any partner networks, so the ad split they get with Google is terrible. So they use proprietary video players, which are almost universally terrible. Terrible! You know, very few of them can get decent HD. The ads on them are way more obnoxious and unskippable. Very few of them are compatible with mobile devices. So again, it's this self-destructive, contradictory element of, we make no money from YouTube, so let's serve videos on our own third-party software, which gets no views and makes no money because no one wants to watch it on this awful, shitty delivery method. That's a big problem, and I don't think Game Trailers is necessarily an example of the death of games media or game, you know, traditional games journalism, so much as it is definitely the shrinkage of it. I think we're going to see various outlets just become more and more prominent and more exclusive. And a lot of the other companies are just going to sort of fall by the wayside. So I feel like your Kotakus, your Polygons, then obviously your massive sites like IGN are still going to be around due to just the way their particular business operates and the fact that they're bankrolled pretty well and they've diversified their content to include more than just games. And they've been able to jump on that kind of BuzzFeedification bandwagon to generate just a whole ton of views with a lot less work. You know, it's a lot better now to just have, say, 10 list articles that get a few thousand views a piece than it is to get one really well-produced, personality-led bit of content. Gets a lot of views, but just doesn't generate as much money because we're in an environment now where you used to be, you could measure your success by how successful you were, and you can't even do that anymore in the old, sort of the old media environment. Your success isn't a measure of how successful you are, which is just ridiculously contradictory. You know, I've been told by companies that as a personality with a show like The Jimquisition, I have no value to them and their ad-supported model because I won't do sponsored content, and I might say things that might annoy advertisers and stuff like that. And I think we're going to see a lot more of what we've seen with myself, with the people at Kinda Funny, with people like Laura Kate, who I co-host Podquisition with, who is still working at Destructoid but still makes the majority of her money and gets the most attention freelance and doing independent stuff. I think we're going to see the personalities break off. People who were once known as the face of the band for various websites will become their own thing, where they can have an audience they value in ways more than just, you know, one percentage of a cent. And the companies, the outlets left without them will be more like BuzzFeed, where it's like you don't really recognize names of writers on BuzzFeed, you just know the brand. So we're going to have this real split between, you know, people who have become their own personal brand and websites that are a brand. Where the two things used to go hand in hand, so there's going to be a hard split between them, which we've seen, you know, with the rise of YouTube and how YouTubers have become these personal brands themselves. So I think that's what we're looking at. We're looking at this schism where the outlet and the individual become so much more distinct. And I spoke for a very long time there, and I do apologize.
Oh, no, these are the kind of conversations we like to have, Jim, because, I mean, you do Jimquisition, you do the podcast, you do other things, and what we want to have is not the standard, oh, this game is great, go buy it, this game sucks, here's why conversations. These are the things we want to have, so feel free to carry on about a question. We're not going to stop you. Because I think the next question will actually probably get a longer answer depending on how you're feeling about it. For those listening, I wrote up the show notes before Unravel came out, before Firewatch came out, and I think it's an interesting question in the face of the particular Killscreen article about Unravel, if you can call that an article.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just felt like it was, their review was, I hate this thing because other people like it and it's sweet and adorable, and I just felt like it was not the right take on trying to claim that Unravel's commodifying our childhood when there's so many other games and remakes and movies that are doing that very thing.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, do you think the games will ever be taken seriously as art form? Because I look at things like Unravel and Firewatch, Gone Home veering more toward art-type games versus, you know, let's go kill everything in sight games.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I used to talk about that a lot. I used to care a lot more about it. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of stopped. I stopped worrying about what the larger society and what mainstream entertainment deems as art and what it doesn't, because ultimately, who cares? Who cares what they have to say? Like, the way I approach it is, does someone think this thing is art? Then it's art. That's what art is. It's a subjective thing. It's about one's personal reaction to it. I personally consider video games an art form. Therefore, to me, they are art. And that's really the be-all end-all as far as I'm concerned, is so long as one person out there considers something to be art, then there's a case to be made for it being art, which is why I've always sort of taken umbrage with the arguments against it being an art form where, you know, oh, it's because you score points, it's because you interact with it in this way. They're just these arbitrary rules of what can and cannot be art.
Mm-hmm.
It's akin to me going into an art gallery and pointing at a painting and say, well, that's not art, it's in a wooden frame. Like, it's that arbitrary. As far as whether I can predict that the modern, you know, the mainstream, rather, mainstream society will consider games art, I think we're already in the shift. I think games have grown up, especially in the last few years, to the point where very few people question their existence now. The time between Fox News blaming a shooting or something terrible on video games is widening. You know, we've recently had people like I think it was PewDiePie was recently on a late night talk show where it's just becoming so much more normal. Gaming has become more normal. You know, to the point where we watch House of Cards and there's Frank Underwood playing Call of Duty and talking about the PS, you know, is that a PS Vita? All that kind of stuff. And I think that's really what it comes down to, is just the ubiquity of a thing and the normalization and the banality of it, in fact. When something actually becomes more banal and normal and boring and mundane, there's a lot less argument for it being considered an art form, because no one has an extreme opposition to it anymore, because what's the point? So I think we're pretty much on the cusp. I think most people who matter, at least to those within the game industry, already consider it an art form. And those that don't matter, who cares? They don't matter. You know, they don't.
Nope, that's totally fair. It was just something I always wonder about, because that's always like that kind of ephemeral argument that never either goes away, like it comes and goes, and it's one of the things I'm always curious about other people's opinions on, because I always considered them art, but you know, you never know what other folks think of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's telling that, I mean, as you say, it never quite goes away, but again, just like with the Fox News thing, the distance between that argument coming up has just grown so much to the point where it's like, it's been years since the last time I've seen a good games as art debate, you know? It's like a thunderstorm, you know, the distance between the thunder strikes has grown. And I think that's just a reflection of more mainstream acceptance.
Yeah, I've always made the argument that some games are art and some aren't. I'm just saying that it's a medium, it's not... I don't believe that video games as a thing are one or the other. It's what we do with it. Because the concept is new.
I mean, yeah, comparatively speaking, yeah. That's an argument that I've heard before, you know, like some games are out, some aren't. And again, I always draw to the think back to just any definition you have to separate the two are going to be somewhat arbitrary. You can look at The Witness or, you know, Firewatch, which came out recently. You can point to those and say, well, that's art for these reasons, whereas Gears of War is not art for these reasons. And I guess I've just always had just such a broad definition and such a personal reaction to art, where I'm like, if someone wants to say Gears of War is art, like, fine. I think I once made an argument just as an intellectual exercise for Gears of War being art. And the fact of the matter is you can make the case for anything. You can make the case for almost anything out there. I could point to a rock and describe why in the context that rock is there, why it's artistic, why it's art, why I had an emotional reaction to this rock. Which I don't say to say dismiss people's opinions on art, but rather to just try and point out that we're all different. We, you know, anyone can have an emotional reaction to anything. And that's why if someone wants to call your most cynically produced AAA, you know, microtransaction-laden video game artistic in some way, that's fine. I'm always more than willing to hear the argument, because I do find that fascinating. I find people's personal reactions to things very fascinating, and in video games more so than anything else.
Speaking of looking at things in different ways than we normally do, Is there anything you've wanted to cover, but you didn't?
I was always going to do a video on why Silent Hill Downpour was a really good game. And I never got round to it. I was going to make a case as to why it was just a really good example of survival horror. And it just... Maybe I'll try and go back to it one day, but maybe not.
Well, you absolutely should.
Because, you know, horror is where I live. And there was a lot of mixed reaction to Downpour, and I was impressed with a lot of things it did. Not everything it did. I thought some of its design elements were really lacking. But one day I'm going to have to go back and just explain exactly why I thought Downpour was just such a really good experience, and why, again, going back to that, you know, the subjectivity of art and everything, why I view it the way I do. I'm very interested in interpreting games as something other than what they're labelled as. Not to sound too waffly and up my own arse, but, you know, in terms of survival horror, you know, I did a video explaining why I thought Bloodborne fit that bill perfectly, despite it being packaged as an action RPG. And some people thought I was reaching, some people agreed, but... You know, I love stuff like that, and that's definitely something I'd like to do more of. That's often my regret, is because I focus a lot on current affairs and being more reaction-y. Sometimes I have to put things on the back burner until I just completely forget about them, or I miss the real window of opportunity to talk about something. And a lot of that stuff, sort of the subjectivity of genre definitions and more game design-y things, are things I often... just sort of put on that back burner and never pick up again.
Oh, that'd be awesome if you did. I would so love to hear about that. So we've gotten a little bit heavy on a few of the questions. So let's have a silly question to kind of start winding down. And if you don't want to answer this, feel free. I just thought it was kind of a fun, silly question. Mm-hmm. What's the strangest rumor you ever heard about yourself?
There have been so many. There's one that my wife decides what games I'm allowed to play and what ones I'm not. That one amuses me no end, amuses her as well. I guess the weirdest one, or at least the one that made me laugh the most, was when Andy Serkis was announced as the voice of Gisborne in Volume, Mike Biffle's stealth game.
Uh-huh.
A certain contingent of individuals decided that the only reason that news was covered on pretty much every video game website was because I was also a voice actor in the game, bearing in mind that I only had a small cameo role in the game. But a lot of people thought that because of this interconnected conspiracy that's controlling games media, apparently I have a lot of power, so much power, that the only reason a bunch of game websites talked about a freaking Hollywood actor being in a video game, in an indie game no less, which is pretty impressive. You know, the news of Andy Serkis being in a game like Volume should be huge news, but the idea that it wasn't huge news until I somehow got involved, like, just gave me so... It lent this idea of so much undue power that I'm still to this day gobsmacked that was a rumor floating around. That I'm more influential in media than Andy Serkis. It's ridiculous.
Wow, that is an impressive rumor.
So, with your apparent, like, godlike influence, do you have any new projects coming up you want to talk about or can talk about?
Let's see. I've got some more voice acting stuff coming up, but I can't really give specifics. Voice acting is something I started doing more and more last year, and I've got some things coming up. In fact, while we were doing this podcast, I just got a call back for an audition I did for a game that I am fairly certain the, your audience will have played and enjoyed, but I can't say any more than that. And there's a certain remake of a certain game that I loved when I was a lot younger coming out that I'm going to be involved in. So this is stuff that's going to be revealed in the relatively near future. Outside of that, there is a video game that I'm more hands-on working on called Jim Sterling's Licensed Game Adventure, where I announced that last year. and we're moving ahead with plans for that, and fingers crossed we'll get that out this year, and that should be a cute little game.
Oh, that'll be fun. You know, if I can use my non-existent influence, I would love to get an early copy and stream it.
Yeah, I there's we're nowhere near that stage of thinking about that.
Ah, okay.
It's going to be fun doing that kind of stuff, because obviously I've always been on the other side of it, so to have my own game where I'm dealing with that kind of PR and marketing and stuff like that, that's going to be fun. So, yeah, like, hit me up as soon as I'm actually talking about having codes and products in my hands, because
awesome.
Because right now I'm waiting to get sort of some key art back, and hopefully I can show that off soon.
Oh, that's awesome. So we've gone through all of our questions, and, you know, like, as you do as well, we solicit questions from our listeners, and we actually got a few. So we got about six. Some things we actually didn't touch on any of these for change, because sometimes we actually... The first one is from Hydramez. I hope I'm saying your Twitter name correctly. They asked, would you ever consider a new series with Yahtzee, and is the Escapist an issue with such plans?
I don't know. At least as far as the Escapist being an issue with things, I've never seen Yahtzee's contract, so I don't know what the deal would be there. I would assume it wouldn't be an issue insofar as he has his own YouTube thing, and it was never an issue for me doing a YouTube, you know, my own YouTube content and original shows while still doing the Jimquisition on the Escapist. So I don't know. Haven't spoken to Yahtzee in a while. You know, we're still on good terms. The last time I spoke to him was... when he'd sent me a copy of The Consuming Shadow, which was his more recent game. And I say never, I'm always open to ideas. I think right now for me the biggest issue I've had with any collaborations is I've worked collaboratively, I've worked as part of a team, I've worked for other people for so long that I'm still, like, even this far out, still just enjoying the relative lack of stress that comes with working solo, not having to coordinate with people so much, being able to run my own ship has just been very freeing. So it's kind of there is an added stress to working with other people on things. Not that what I don't do now doesn't have its own set of stresses, but I am very sensitive to the fact that I handle stress badly. Right now I've just been I still feel like I'm coming down from several years of the stresses that come with working with other people. there are certainly no plans for collaborative stuff right now, but never say never. There's a lot of people I'd love to work with, and at the very least do, like, you know, one-off things with. And like I said, still consider myself on good terms with the Yahtzee. So, you know, something could happen one day.
Jolt Studios asks, have you ever had flack for talking out against the likes of Gamergate/internet harassment?
Let me think. short answer, yes. It's funny because the other day someone sent me an anonymous message saying that the only reason I criticized those particular groups was because I was terrified of the attacks I'd get from quote-unquote professional victims and feminists and that sort of stuff. And I'm like, well, to be fair, even back when I was, you know, this wannabe Howard Stern shock jock arsehole, ain't no feminist ever threatened my family. That all happened after I made it quite clear that I want nothing to do with certain third-party individuals. So, yeah, it definitely comes with flack. I mean, I think now more than ever there's hostility just for praising something vaguely progressive in a game. I mean, I did an episode of the Jimquisition a while back where I talked about polyamory in Fallout 4, and that was the cue for certain groups of people to start yelling at me that I was a cuck, once again displaying their flagrant misunderstanding of that particular word and its term and its meaning. You know, for the record, cuckoldry, if that's for you, that's fine. I'm not into it, so... You know, the use of that word as an insult just amuses me no end as someone who is very interested in alternative lifestyles. and I just think, oh, honey, like, you really don't know what you're talking about. So, yeah, short answer, the short answer is yes. Obviously, yes. I mean, it comes with the territory. If you are not with certain groups, you are considered against them. It's like Scientology in that regard, except no one has a cool boat like Ron Hubbard did.
Yeah, I always kind of laugh at the use of cuck because I'm like, can't you find a more modern word that is accurate?
Yeah. I mean, there's lots. It doesn't take much stretching of the imagination to come up with something. But at the same time, I admire their ability to use it in other words. Their ability to use it in portmanteaus and other things is, I mean, it's pretty impressive. I mean, when Donald Trump lost in Iowa and everyone started calling, well, say everyone, I mean, certain groups of his supporters started calling it the Iowa Caucus. I mean, well done. I love a good pun. So cuckus, cuckservative, like, you get on with your bad self.
Oh, and kind of dovetailing into that, another question we got was from Mighty Greg Doge. Do you remember what inspired you to be more careful about the language you use in your content?
I don't think it was... I can point to a specific thing. It was always, like I said at the top of the show, there's a gradual thing there. To the point where I could never look back and say, that was the moment. It just got to the point where I was like, I just realized I hadn't been using certain words, I hadn't been using certain turns of phrases. And whereas before I'd be so happy using them, and even happy using them to shock people and be an arsehole with them, hearing them would kind of take me back a little bit. I can't point to a specific instance, a specific date, or a specific moment. It was an evolutionary thing. It's just something that happened and progressed over time, to the point where I just have no interest in using certain terms and phrases and words anymore. And I found that interesting because a lot of people consider that kind of quote-unquote self-censorship, that kind of language policing or whatever, to be restrictive, whereas I find it oddly liberating because it forces you to use your imagination to the point where you don't just use the same old phrase like cuck over and over again to insult someone. You actually have to work for it and come up with something fresh and inventive. And I feel that's made me a better writer, it's made me a better producer of content because I come up with, you know, I start every, I do like a Let's Play series on my YouTube channel, and I start every single one with some over-the-top insult towards my own audience as a kind of parody on people that come up with endearing terms for their fans, you know, like the Angry Joe Army or PewDiePie's Bros. You know, I'll come up with something just different and insulting every time, and not leaning into the really obvious words just allows me to come up with really fanciful, still utterly disgusting and appalling, but more inclusively, which I feel is just the best way to be appalling.
Awesome. David, you're up.
Yep. Thane, 1982, Tim, who's been on the show twice now.
Yes.
He asks, what's the worst game you've ever played? The one you wouldn't wish. The one you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy.
I mean, it's oddly difficult to answer, just because when in terms of what's worse, what we deem as worst, there are different factors that in different circumstances would lead to a different answer. I mean, like, in terms of some of the most unpleasant experiences I've ever had, just playing a game in the moment. Stuff like, obviously, Digital Homicide's work, The Slaughtering Grounds, which became legendarily terrible, is just almost, you know, all opinions are subjective, but that's as close as you can get to objectively bad. You know, I play a lot of stuff that ends up on Steam ever since Steam opened its floodgates, and I could point to all sorts of things that are just utterly, astonishingly bad. Things that are just so poorly optimized, have such terrible field of view, have such, that are just so visually bad that they've given me legit migraines. You know, there are games I've played that are still on sale on Steam that are actually physically painful to play. But then on the other side, we can talk about, you know, some of the worst games I've played. You know, I'm thinking about games that I've given my award to. I do the top 10 shittiest games every year, and other games have won that award for different reasons other than just being bad from a mechanical standpoint. You've got things like Final Fantasy All the Bravest, Dungeon Keeper mobile games that are just so offensive from a business standpoint and a production standpoint, in terms of how they cynically try and get money out of their audience. There's some of the, you know, I would say objectively the worst game, Dungeon Keeper Mobile, does come to mind. But then when you talk about wishing something on your worst enemy, most of that game's, you know, just waiting 24 hours while an imp chops up a brick, which isn't really, you know, painful to play, as it is just philosophically atrocious and offensive and intellectually insulting. They could, what's that, was it Steel Battalion or something? Oh, the Kinect version that Capcom brought out. Like, if you want something that you that is just so horrible to try and play that not even your worst enemy is someone you'd wish it on, that also is in the running. That's one of the few games I've looked at and said, like, the fact that wasn't recalled should be an actual investigation, because that was just an undeniably broken product and not one of those, not Ubisoft broken, where it's like, well, it still technically works and we can patch it till it's better. It's like, no, that was like defective. Wow. It did not work. So that would be another example. So I guess it's a three-way split between your Dungeon Keeper Mobile, your Steel Battalion Kinect, and your Slaughtering Grounds.
Thankfully, I've skipped all of those. So we did touch a little bit on green light stuff earlier, but Tim had another question about that. So you do a lot of those green light / early access features. Do you think it's a positive trend for PC games?
Fundamentally, yes. In theory, yes. It becomes one of those, does the good outweigh the bad? And I'm not sure I can answer that because I don't know. The trouble is early access has brought us some wonderful things. It's brought us things like Necro. It's brought us things like Darkest Dungeon. There's a game called Slime Rancher right now that is looking set to be something really special. And it's like, does the good that those games bring outweigh the sheer volume of utter dross? Because, I mean, make no mistake, you look at Steam Early Access and the ratio of genuinely excellent examples of early access done right compared to the ones that are terrible, like, it's not even a contest. Like, it's so overwhelmingly full of chances taking the piss, just these utter weapons that put their games up on early access, calling them like alpha builds, and they clearly don't understand what an alpha build actually is. You know, there are games that have been put up with no gameplay, and I'm not talking, you know, the people that you know, look at Gone Home or something and say, that's not a game. I mean, there's literally no gameplay. It's stuff there that actually makes me consider the term not a game to have some merit. There was a game called Dragon, for example, that was literally a map with a flying dragon. And that was it. That was it. Like, you just steered the dragon around until you reached the end of the map and realised that nothing else had been coded beyond there. And there's just so much of that. So it really comes down to what you value. It's like, is the Darkest Dungeon worth 100 dragons? And I would probably say yes, just because, you know, I fucking love the Darkest Dungeon, and I'm glad it's here. And if I had to wade through, you know, all of these terrible early access games that I have to play day in, day out until I feel my psychological makeup crumbling, I would say it's worth it. I would say it's worth it. So yeah, like, For the few nuggets of gold that Greenlight and Early Access have allowed to reach an audience, I would say overall it is worth it.
Okay. So what's the one game you'll always go back to and think everyone should play at least once?
Ideally, that's sort of a, you know, what's your favourite game? Although I get there's a bit more nuance to that. But I guess for me, the game that I've probably played through more times than any, and a game that I still think is just a beautiful experience from beginning to end, would be Silent Hill 2. In terms of games as an art form, I mean, the things that game does with nuance and subtlety and metaphor, the hidden depths to that game beyond just a scary survival horror game is just, I mean, that's a game that's so much darker and more macabre than its surface level lets on. And its surface level is dark as hell and macabre as hell. And then once you actually start thinking about the psychology of the characters and really learn what things mean in that game, it's just, it's utterly beautiful, and in the bleakest, most dismal way possible, it's utterly beautiful. And I do feel like anyone who, especially anyone who wants to talk about games criticism, wants to talk about games as an art form, even if they end up not liking it, I feel it would always benefit them immensely to give that game a try.
Excellent. I'm trying to think if I finished Silent Hill 2, because it's been so long since I touched a Silent Hill game. Because I'm a big old scaredy cat. I downloaded PT before they took it off the PSN store. And I tried it. I got to the part where the radio turned on by itself. And then I wandered around and opened a door, and a little girl looked at me, and I was like, done. I can't.
Nope.
Down so quick.
Yeah, I mean, one of the beautiful things about Silent Hill 2 is it's good to watch as well. So if you are too nervous to play it, like if you can get someone to play it for you and watch, that's how I used to experience games with my brother back in the day, and it's how my wife got to enjoy the Metal Gear Solid games and the Silent Hill games is sort of watching me play them, because, you know, there are certain games she either doesn't get on with mechanically, or, you know, she's too scared to play, like Silent Hill. So yeah, definitely, at the very least, I feel people would benefit from watching a playthrough.
Yeah, I've actually still got my PS2, so I could play it. No one said I should play it alone in the dark, but I can play it. Because I still get creeped out by the original Resident Evil when the dogs jump through the window.
And that's one of those things where it's like holding a pin to a balloon, where it's like you know what's coming, and that still doesn't stop you jumping. Like, the dogs in the window in Resident Evil, it's still, when I play it, I'm like, here it comes. Ah, it came. Oh, God.
Silent Hill is, I like to differentiate it from Resident Evil, because it's more of an oppressive atmosphere. There aren't really many jump scares in Silent Hill games.
No. To the point where, like, the ones it does do are just so much more memorable. Like, there's only one thing in Silent Hill 2 that ever made me jump, which is when I'm on the hospital roof and Pyramid Head just appears on screen. It's not even a real... there's no jumping out and banging. There's no loud scream or discordant violin. It's just one moment silence and one moment something's there. And it's just so... It's the most subtle jump scare I've ever seen, and yet it's just so effective. And partially because there are so few legitimate jump scares in it, that something so understated can be so terrifying. And again, that's just part of the subtlety of Silent Hill 2. At a period where games were even less subtle, I'd say, than they are now. And it's still one that is just, I hold up as just a master of nuanced storytelling and progression and atmosphere.
Nuance scares and things like that to me are far more terrifying than the obvious.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
What was the movie where aliens invade and it was all shaky cam, and the first glimpse you saw of aliens was like at a kid's birthday party and someone captured the video of them? I'm blanking on the name. But that was one of those films where it was like far more effective, because you could think, this is how we might actually see aliens the first time, not this great, you know, splash on the news. It's like someone accidentally catching a glimpse of them, and that kind of spreading virally.
Yeah. I mean, I've said that before, like, real violence, real horror, real, just all of the real terrible things that are covered in entertainment, in real life, they're so understated.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an example I once used on a really old Jimquisition, where people talk about how affecting video game violence is. And so to demonstrate how it doesn't desensitize you to violence, I showed some of the infamous Bud Dwyer footage, in which a man takes his own life. And it's such a quiet, almost like mundane, banal thing. And that's what's truly terrifying about it, is that's how lives end. That's how violence happens. It's not big Hollywood punches in the face with big smack sound effects. Car accidents are not, you know, I've witnessed a terrible car accident, and it's not tires screeching and cars flipping. It's just one moment something's normal, one moment something's not. And that's truly horrifying. That's really what makes something scary, is the idea that your normal life and everything you recognize can just go. It can just change on a dime. And that's something that, you know, most entertainment struggles to communicate, especially because there's this worry that it's not believable if it's not bombastic. If a punch hits a face, you know, if a fist hits a face and we don't hear a Hollywood smack, rather than sort of the wet thud that you actually get if you get a sound at all, you know, there's this worry it's not believable. But those moments where I've seen movies do a real fight where there is none of that bombast, that's the stuff that I find more evocative and stays with me. And, you know, I realize I got way serious even when we were like, are we going to do the silly questions now?
Oh, no, it's fine.
That's something I feel a game like Silent Hill captures better than a lot of horror games, is because it keeps it quiet. And that's what gets under your skin. It's the quiet nature of things, the subtle changes, the one moment and everything's different. You know, none of this huge explosive alteration. Just the evolution of something not being right is just so much more better to me and so much more effective. And I wish games overall had learned more from Silent Hill 2, but, you know, not even people developing Silent Hill games learned enough from Silent Hill 2, because they think the only thing that matters is having another pyramid head or a pyramid head XP, you know, because that's all they care about, is that surface level stuff. And it's like, that's not why that game was scary, you know. I mean, hell, it's not like Pyramid Head wasn't scary just because it swung a big knife around. It's the stuff that was going on under the visuals, the stuff it represented, the stuff it meant, the metaphor of it, the idea of it is scarier than the physical representation of it. But that's me just, again, going waffly and up my own arse.
That's okay. The last thing we usually do is talk about what we're playing / reading. And as our guest, you get to go first.
Oh, okay. The main thing I've been playing this week, at least, is Unravel. Been playing Unravel. I'm almost done with it, I feel, so I should be able to review that on the day that I'm recording this. So I'm looking forward to getting that done. Not found myself as taken with it as a lot of other people, I don't feel. I don't know if maybe I expected a bit too much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Like, it's mechanically and physically, it feels like I'm playing a Little Big Planet level, and Little Big Planet's platforming isn't very good, mostly because a lot of, you know, the effort and the draw of it is building your own levels. So I feel like a lot of the times I'm playing a Little Big Planet level with puzzles that are no more evolved from, you know, when I played the exact same types of puzzles back in when I played Limbo, which had just a much more arresting atmosphere. So I feel like it's a game that's kind of walking in the footsteps of games that had a lot more going on. It's not bad. I'm not having a terrible time with it, but I've got to say, I've been a bit disappointed with it.
Okay. Any thoughts on Firewatch before?
Yes. I've only played about 40 minutes of Firewatch so far, basically enough to get a video up for it. And then once I'm done with Unravel, I intend to play through Firewatch so I can get a review of that. At least so far, it's looking to tick every box I have when it comes to story-driven games. A lot of I'm very sort of on the fence with a lot of what people call walking simulators. You know, I know there are a lot of people that are ardent defenders of it, and a lot of people that just like absolutely hate them. And I've very much been a case-by-case basis. You know, I'm a guy who really didn't like Dear Esther, really loved Stanley Parable, very on the fence with Gone Home. To me, it's all about, if you're not having combat, if you're not really having puzzles, what are you doing instead? There's a lot of games, several games came out last year that sold themselves as having no combat. Like, that was their big selling point. And I'm like, don't tell me what you don't have. Tell me what you have, you know? I don't care whether you've got combat or not, so long as you've got something else. So we had a game like Wanda came out, there's a game like Submerged that came out, and you were literally just walking around in most of the cases. Like, the term walking simulator really meant something there, because that's all you were doing. There wasn't even a story in Wanda. You were just wandering around, like, true to its name, you were just wandering around aimlessly looking at stuff, looking at a world where clearly narratively within the world, people were invested and people had done things before you, but you couldn't do any of those things. And I get very frustrated by games like that, where it's like, don't show me this beautiful world and stop me from being able to interact with it, from feeling like I have a place in it, from making me feel like I'm a glorified cameraman. You know, I want to be in this world, and that's what Firewatch has at least so far done. Like, it's mechanically, you know, yeah, you're not fighting things, you're not really going out of your way to solve puzzles and all this stuff, but I can interact with the world. It's a beautiful world, and I'm doing things, you know, I'm having radio conversations, I'm picking things up, I'm investigating, I'm exploring, and I feel like I belong there, which is really, it's all I ask for from any of these games. I like it, you know, the thing that separates a video game from other forms of media is that sense of reaction. And that doesn't have to be, you know, shooting an alien and watching it die. It's just allowing me to have some sort of effect on the world that I'm in. I don't like to feel like I'm not involved, like I am just holding the camera so that a story can be told. That's not for me. And Firewatch definitely so far is avoiding all that. It's, I feel like I'm part of that story, part of that world. I'm not just holding the camera and letting some story rattle itself off at me, you know?
Okay. Interesting. Well, I want to get David and what he's been watching, since he's been super busy and not playing a lot lately, before I kind of give my two cents on Unravel and Firewatch.
Yeah, I haven't really had an opportunity to play anything new that I haven't already talked about on this podcast. I really want to replay Silent Hill now, so there's that. But I have been watching, keeping up with TV, and I think Agent Carter is handling itself really well, to the extent where the plot line is like a little too on the nose on certain like social justice-y issues.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
So they've introduced this, what was his name, like Wilkes, because there were no people of color in the first season who weren't evil. Or Howling Commandos.
Yeah, it's okay. I too have been playing Unravel and Firewatch. And Unravel for me is just like, this is my fun game where I can squeal and joy about a ball of yarn. Although
it is cute. I can't argue that. It is adorable.
But I actually was streaming it yesterday, and I quit because I got to a puzzle where I literally was a few inches short of yarn. Like, I struggled with this puzzle on stream for like 30 minutes. Finally solved it, and then couldn't reach the next pool of yarn. And I was just like, damn it.
I've been there.
It's the Bury Mine one, after you get through the water. Like, you make the log float, and then you have to get it across.
Uh-huh.
And I...
Oh, wow. You ran out of yarn. Oh.
Yeah, and you...
Yeah, I can imagine that being heartbreaking.
I was just like, really? Really? How? And I redid the puzzle, like, three times, and still couldn't figure out how to manipulate the yarn so I could, like, get that last couple of inches to reach. Because you can see the spool. It's right there. And I'm just like, son of a bitch.
Yeah, it is surprisingly just mentally taxing and like really distressing to see the next checkpoint, and you're reaching out for it and you just can't because you're out of yarn.
I was like, I got upset because I felt like Yarny also looks just so sad and thin when he's out of yarn. I'm just like, I'm so sorry. Like, I apologize to a ball of yarn. But Firewatch, interestingly enough, it was hard for me to play on two levels. One, because the narrative choices you make in the beginning before you start your ranger job were almost triggering for me because of some of the things that the character goes through. And then when you do get to the ranger outpost, the way that his supervisor talks to him definitely was triggering because I've had abusive supervisors. So that was hard to hear, and I just felt like they weren't super... Like, the supervisor's not helpful if you lose your way, because I kind of got turned around, lost my objective, and the way that she spoke to me through the radio, and then she doesn't talk to you anymore. It's like, I'm lost out here, you know, this isn't helpful. I'm going to go back to it. And, you know, admittedly, I was not having the best day when I tried to play this game, but it was just emotionally much more raw than I expected.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you felt that, because I was just like, okay, I'm upset. Like, I'm streaming this. This is very emotionally upsetting. And that's not what I expected at all. And maybe it's like I didn't have the right idea about what Firewatch was about.
I've been hearing that a lot. Like, I don't feel I'm far enough yet to really get to the meat of it.
Okay.
Very much looking forward to doing so. But I've definitely been hearing, like, that's been the big sticking point with a lot of people, is it's not been what anyone truly expected.
Yeah, because, I mean, and granted, when people hear this, it'll be in a week or so, and the game will have been out, and people have had a chance to play through it. I felt the narrative decision on how your protagonist can get to where they take this ranger job was, it felt almost like fridging to me. And maybe it's because the choices I made to get up to that point, but it just seemed very dark. Like, it got dark real quick. So maybe it's just me. And I will go back and I may just start the game over and see what other choices lead me to. But it's visually stunning and the music's amazing. And I'm definitely going to finish it out. But I also heard the usual complaint of, oh my God, it's such a short game. But it's only $20. People pay $60 for games that have little to no replay value, yet they're complaining about a game that costs $20.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of the big... that's one of the modern debates that doesn't look set to ever go away, well, at least for a long time, is that whole cost to length ratio, which I sympathize with up to a point. It's, you know, people value their money and they want to make sure they get a certain amount of experience out of it. I don't know, I'm always sort of very contextualized with that. Like, sometimes you buy a game and it's 4 hours long and the 4 hours feel wasted. And some are 4 hours long and they don't feel wasted at all. And I think it comes down to, what are you doing with the time you have? Not necessarily how long is the game. It's what is it doing with its time? And is that worth money to you? And to me, like, I'll spend $20 on something that's, you know, 3 hours, but really, like, affecting and sticks with me for a long time, than, you know, I would for something that's 80 hours long and is just boring as hell.
Yeah. And the other thing I've been playing is XCOM 2, which is much harder than the previous game. I played XCOM since the original DOS games, and I got my ass kicked. Like, I had to redo the very first mission, like, 2 or 3 times before I could complete it. Because I don't know if you've played it or will play it, Jim, but they've added a mechanic of finite turns to complete your immediate objective.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I strategy games are not my thing.
Okay.
Like, some people have wondered where a review is for it, and I'm like, good luck. Like, I might, I can't do them. I don't have the brain for them.
It's a challenge, and I would say if strategy is not your thing, especially turn-based strategy, just run far, far away. Watch other people play it. Just don't try it yourself.
I mean, it looks fantastic, but I'm like, no, I can't touch them. I will never get past the first level because I'm too impulsive, can't plan ahead, no foresight whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy it, but it is a bit frustrating, but I'll stick with it because I bought the game, and I'm just hard-headed that way. But that sadly brings us to the end of this awesome time talking with you. So thank you so much for making time in your morning to hang out with us and have wonderful conversation, Jim.
No problem. It was a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me along.
Oh yeah, it was great to have you.
We would like people to know where to find you, as if they don't already.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter, I guess, at Jim Sterling, which is also the name of my YouTube channel, just Jim Sterling, all one word. And my reviews and my weekly postings of The Jimquisition and my podcast work can all be found at thejimquisition.com. And I cannot urge enough that it must be thejimquisition.com, because purveyors of hentai squatted on jimquisition.com, so you might not want to go there, especially if you're at work.
Oh dear. Okay then. Remember that, dear listeners. David, where can people find you?
I can be found at davidoreeves.com. I'm a fiction editor by trade. And other than that, I can also be found on Twitter at redconversation, on Twitch at @red_conversation and on Patreon at patreon.com/redconversation.
And I'm CypherTier everywhere. My website, Twitter, and even Xbox Live handle is now CypherTier. So if you find one and it's not me, I'm sorry. Some poor soul has decided to impersonate me, and that's not the way to go, let me tell you. And with that, we are done with this episode. Thank you again, Jim, and we will see you all in a week.
Now, I do, blimey, I do like 3 podcasts at the moment, and none of them are professional at all, so... You know, this is par for the course for me.